Okay, so we are here with our interview for election coverage that we do every cycle here, and we're joined by Mike Seip, candidate for Oregon House District 53, running in the Republican primary, I believe unopposed for sure. So Mike is a Christian leadership coach, best-selling author, husband, dad, community leader, Cold War Army Ranger officer. He lives in Tumalo, where he's a local businessman and outdoor adventurer. Mike, thank you for joining us.
Bruce, good to see you today.
So you're running unopposed, and the Democrat in the primary is running unopposed for District 53, and the same thing for 55, and the same thing for 54. So the question I have for you is, tell us why it's so important for people to vote anyway, even though a lot of these races are unopposed in the primary.
Well, that's a great question, and it really is important to stress it, because unfortunately, in off years, off presidential years, and also in midterm elections, primaries, frequently see a real fall off in voting. And that's unfortunate, because basically what it means is that people are not as engaged in the issues as they could be, and the outcomes aren't as good as they could be. The other thing that is changed a lot in most districts in Oregon, and certainly in 53, is that the non-affiliated voters have sort of drawn out of the primary process, and I can understand why, because it's been a pretty frustrating time in politics. But when you've got more than a third of the voters in our district that are non-affiliated, then the primaries are also reduced, and I think that's unfortunate that a good chunk of the population isn't getting a chance to shape the nature of the elections.
So, a quick follow-up. Do you think we should have open primaries in Oregon, where you don't necessarily have to be a member of the party to vote in that party's primary?
There's arguments pro and con on that. Fundamentally, I think that the two-party system, when it works well, because the idea behind the two-party system and the idea behind legislation, for example, in the Constitution, is a well-grounded debate or dialogue or discourse. And I think if it's just chaotic, that's going to be more problematic. So the two-party system actually, when it works, works really well.
Okay. So, all right. So one of the things then I noticed looking at your website is that both on the homepage that I just read, basically the about Mike I just read was straight from your homepage, and then on your about Mike page, you start out with Christian leadership coach, and that you're a Christ follower. And so I'm wondering why do you put that first?
Great question, because it is first. So whenever people evaluate the motives, whenever people evaluate the potential behavior of someone, it's really important to know what they believe in. And there's an old saying my dad used to have. He said, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. And so it's really important to, I think, express initially the foundations of how I'm likely to behave and how I'm likely to think, which are based on ancient wisdom. So it could be ancient Hebrew wisdom coming from the Old Testament, or it could be New Testament wisdom. But fundamentally, it's pretty easy to figure out how I'm likely to think from that foundation, which I think should actually be comforting, regardless of whether someone agrees with biblical principles or agrees with that as my foundation. I think people should be comforted to know that I actually have a foundation.
Okay, and so what does that mean then for your representation of the 53rd district?
Well, it means there's a fundamental Christian morality that is going to guide my thinking and guide my my decision-making as we evaluate particular policies and bills. So at the heart of Christianity is love. Now, there's an excess of love or compassionate love that's not coupled with truth. So truth and love together is really, when you look at the scripture from the New Testament and the Old Testament combined, you have a combination of truth and love. And that provides a balance that actually leads to building people up.
All right. So I'd like to move to some of the issues that you list on your on your website, and they're, you know, typical really of the kinds of issues that most of us are focused on here in Central Oregon, and one of them you talk about affordable housing.
Sure.
So what are your thoughts? What are your plans? And we all know that's an issue here. So what are your plans for affordable housing here in the area?
So there's different kinds of affordable housing. There's housing for the homeless, for example. Then there's low income housing, and then there's affordable workforce housing, and then there's housing for just folks. And the area that I'm the most interested in actually is affordable workforce housing, because that's a major problem in our region, and it is one that can be addressed, and it can be addressed in two ways. One, the affordable housing projects need some specific government action to be able to help them. They need some funding, and they need some regulatory help in order to be able to put these projects together. That's something that can be addressed at the state and also at the local level. The other thing that's really a problem in terms of affordable workforce housing is the urban growth boundary and the artificial restrictions that Oregon state government has put on expansion. And that's a big problem and a big project, but it's one that we have to address.
So why workforce? I guess when you say workforce, what do you mean by workforce?
I mean the nurses, the doctors, the teachers, the policemen, the firemen, the folks that work at Brightwood, for example, up in Redmond. I just toured there a couple of days ago. So the folks that actually do productive work in our society. Because here's the thing, only business makes money. So government thinks it makes money, but it doesn't. It just spends money. So business is the only thing that makes money. And when you restrict business, and one way that business is restricted in Central Oregon and throughout Oregon is through difficulties for people to live here. If people can't find a place to live, they aren't going to join our workforce. And what that does is it reduces productivity, and that impacts all of us because only business makes money.
Okay. And so what? How would workforce housing look different than other kinds of housing, or would it?
Well, sure. I mean, the difference between a fully employed nurse, for example, or a fully employed teacher not being able to come here and not being able to work because they can't find a place to live, I mean, that has a huge impact in the quality of life and the social fabric of our region. That's a dramatically different issue than someone living in a tent. I'm not speaking badly about the person living in the tent. I'm just trying to answer your question that's an entirely different issue, because when we can help the person who wants to live and work here be able to find a house and afford to live here, everybody's life gets better, including the person living in a tent.
Okay. And so and then I guess the other question logically and which is a big issue here is, are the people living in the tents or otherwise really either homeless or unhoused or housing insecure? What are your thoughts or your plans on dealing with that part of the housing issue?
Sure. So I have an article that's running right now in Cascade Business News. It's in the online version, and it's also coming out in the hard copy version in a few days that addresses that specifically. So I want to talk about it from the state level, because I'm running for a state office, not from the local level. I have strong views on the local level, but I want to talk about it from the state level. So the biggest problem that we have going on right now in regard to this issue is the failure of Measure 101. So Measure 101 is the law that was passed that decriminalizes the possession of hard drugs. Okay, and while I actually don't have a whole lot of argument with the idea that we shouldn't take someone with one pill and throw them in prison, the problem is that the implementation of the law has failed in a couple of ways. Number one, there's no inducement for someone who has an addiction problem to get help. So there's no teeth to it, either through mandated treatment or whatever. There's none of that in the Measure 110 bill. And so what we have is basically just a relief of the criminalization issue. And from a common sense perspective, you can really expect that would increase drug abuse and addiction and mental illness. And guess what? That's going on in a big way. And that's a major impetus for the homeless issue. Second thing is at the state level is that we haven't done the other half of the promise, because the other half of the promise was to build treatment facilities. And we need treatment facilities regardless of Measure 110 and decriminalization, because we have people with serious issues that need help. And our state is remarkably devoid. We're in the bottom of the nation in terms of mental health and addiction treatment facility, bottom of the nation, just in an abysmal way. And that was the other promise of Measure 110, to put those in, and we haven't done it. So those two things really need to get addressed.
And so let me start with the second part, the treatment part, because this is also something that I agree is an important issue in Oregon. How do we get the funding to create those treatment centers or treatment process? Right, it would just not necessarily only centers, but where does that funding come from?
Well, Oregon is awash in cash. We have so much money, it's ridiculous. The issue is not whether we have enough money, it's whether we have the right priorities to use it where it really matters. So Measure 110 provided for funding for the building of the treatment facilities. And so there's no shortage of cash to do it. There just appears to be a will to actually get it done. You could put one of these facilities together and staff it with a doctor and a couple of nurses and build it out nicely for a couple million dollars. We spent nearly $1 billion on things that are not nearly as high a priority as building those centers just in the last session.
Okay, so what is your view on why those funds weren't spent for treatment?
Well, I'm an outsider. I'm not a politician, and I'm not there right now, so I do not understand. It doesn't make any sense to me, which is one of the reasons I'm running, because it seems that common sense has left the building in state government.
And what is there – this, because this is something I wasn't aware of. Is there data to support that drug use and problems related to it have gone up since the passage of Measure 110?
Sure, but I don't have it in my pocket. But yeah, it's absolutely defensible.
Defensible. All right. Okay. So let's move on. The other thing, and this is related that's an issue in Oregon is affordable health care, access to affordable health care. And I know we have OHP, and that's a great system that I really think it's Oregon should be proud of that. But I'm wondering about other people who maybe perhaps don't qualify for OHP, or the subsidies and that sort of thing. What are your plans for that?
That's an area that I don't really have a lot of focus on. And don't have a good answer to that question, because it hasn't been an area that has been a huge area of interest to me. Not that it's not uninteresting, but there's only so many things you can really focus on, and that's not one that I focused on at this time. I probably would not be looking for a seat on a committee in the healthcare arena, not because it's not important, not because it's not interesting. There's just other things, particularly in budget and finance, that are, and taxation and resources, ways and means, that are a lot more interesting to me, and where my business background is a lot more applicable.
So I know another thing that I wanted to sort of talk about for you was that, and really I think there are two things that in my view that sort of work together. One, you talked a little bit about in your view an excessive use of emergency power by the governor. I'm assuming you're speaking about the COVID stuff primarily. And then you also talk about the relationship between government and small business. And to me, those seem to be sort of a similar philosophy, I guess, of, and when I say philosophy, I'm guessing that's the right word for me to use, of how government relates to society and how government relates to business. So can you talk about that and how you would address those things as a representative?
Sure. So let's do it. First of all, in terms of something that is a major problem for everybody in Oregon and across the country, but specifically here in Oregon and Central Oregon, and that's inflation. So inflation is really caused by three things in our current environment. Number one, it's caused by the government lockdowns and restrictions. and the disruption that that caused to our economy, and then the resultant disruption to the workforce and to small business, and then finally to the supply shortages that we're currently seeing all over the place that all tie back into all of these disruptions. Because if you think back to 2019, so I'm a business guy and I coach business men and women throughout our region and across the country. And 2019 was probably one of the best years that anybody ever had in business. And 2020 was looking to be even better. And then the lockdowns happened. And the whole economy was turned upside down. And we are living in the middle of that in terms of the inflation that we're seeing right now and the problems and the employment issues and everything. So this all came from the imposition of lockdowns and regulations and restrictions in the states that did it. Now, in the states that didn't impose those, they're not seeing anywhere near the problems that we're seeing in Oregon. But the overreach at the executive branch and the breach of the balance of powers in Oregon is a major cause of the inflation that every single household in Oregon is suffering with right now.
And, okay, so just to... what would you have done to deal with the COVID epidemic, if not put in the shelter in place, mask mandates, and that sort of thing?
Sure. So I'm running for state representative, not for governor. However, I have some pretty strong opinions on that. The first thing is that whenever. So I'm a military guy and a military background, and the first thing that you do as a military officer, a military leader, is when faced with an unexpected challenge, is you slow down. You go slow to go fast. And what that does is it eliminates the initial panic reaction. And what we did at the U.S. level, so this is not just the governor level, but certainly at the state level, is we panicked. And we made poor decisions and then doubled and tripled and quadrupled down on those decisions, as unfortunately happens in politics, because it's pretty hard for a politician to admit that they did anything wrong, particularly as it gets farther and farther along. So I would have slowed way down, and I would have talked to the population of Oregon candidly. I would have said, hey, this is new ground that we're in. So here's what we're going to do. We want you guys to be prudent and responsible, and we're going to be prudent and responsible, and we're going to take the next 3 or 4 weeks, and we're going to really dig into this and try and figure out what it is that we have our hands on. And every time we learn something, we're going to talk to you about it, and we're going to share what we're learning and some of our conclusions, and then we're going to get after this as a state together, rather than me just mandating you will do this stuff. And because every action has consequences, and unfortunately we're living in the consequences of the actions at the beginning of COVID. Now, we've been living in them, but we continue to live in those. And it's not just the consequences that could be logically expected. It's the unanticipated consequences, or consequences that someone just actually didn't anticipate, that are likely to happen when you shut down a whole economy for 2 years.
Do you think fewer people would have gotten sick and died had we moved slower with those things?
Sure. This is such a controversial question. And I believe that we pursued excessive policies that were not necessary, and that the impact of those policies are wide-ranging in terms of mental health, in terms of the health and education impact on our kids, in terms of the health and relational impact on families. So whenever you talk about health, you have to talk about health holistically. And we went after one solution, but the consequences of it and the fallout of it are dramatic, and we're all living in the middle of that lousy decision.
Okay, so where'd you do your service? I'm just curious, as a veteran.
So I served on the East German border. Spent a little time that shall not be talked about behind enemy lines.
Okay, and, sure, of course.
In the middle of the Cold War.
Yeah, cool. All right, now that's great. I was just curious about that. I ran into a whole group of veterans in West Germany in the mid-80s. Had a lot of fun with him. I'm guessing we weren't having Diet Pepsi together that time.
We were down in Sachsenhausen tipping a few back, yeah, pretty much.
Something different. All right. So thank you very much, Mike Seip, running for representative for District 53 here in Central Oregon. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks a lot, Bruce. Really appreciate the opportunity.